welcome to episode 184 of the Rated NA podcast. It's just me, Ash. Matt and Scott are taking a bit of a break for the holidays. We have a special episode today, and that is with author Patrick Weeks, who is one of the writers on Dragon Age Inquisition. Just a warning ahead of time, this is a very spoiler-filled episode, so unless you've beaten Dragon Age Inquisition, you should skip it. Well, press play and then walk away for a couple hours so we still get the credit for you listening to it. But then skip it and come back and listen to it again when you've actually beaten Dragon Age Inquisition. This episode is brought to you by Loot Crate. If you wanted to help out our podcast and you want great stuff delivered to your house every single month, go to lootcrate.com/ratedNA and save 10% with the code RATEDNA. We subscribe to Loot Crate and they send us a box full of mysteries every single month. We open it up, and inside are some of our favorite things. December's was actually the anniversary-themed box, and inside was stuff from Batman 75th, Ghostbusters 30th, Simpsons 25th, and a whole lot more. January should be announced very soon, so if you want to get in on the Loot Crate and collect some fun, amazing toys and collectibles and shirts and fun things, then please head on over to lootcrate.com/ratedNA. Here is our chat with author Patrick Weeks, all about Dragon Age Inquisition, and again, look out for the spoilers. I'm here with Patrick Weeks, he's back for round three. Welcome, Patrick Weeks.
Thanks for having me.
That's amazing. Well, thank you for coming back. It's rare people come back for round three. Normally, they're tired of us by now. And we have another guest, friend of the podcast, Kate Dollarhide, is here. And Kate's done some writing for us in the past and is a pal of the show. And she's beaten Dragon Age Inquisition multiple times. So I figured who better to have on the show to talk about Dragon Age Inquisition. So welcome, Kate.
Hello. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks. Thanks for being happy. Most people aren't happy. I'm just kidding. Everyone's happy to be on Nerd Appropriate. So Patrick, man, there's so much to talk about. I reached out a few weeks ago and I was like, I would love to have you on and just talk about the game because you wrote a lot of stuff in the game. And I've been playing the game pretty much nonstop since it came out, and I've been really, really loving it. So I think this is a great opportunity for me to just kind of gush a little bit and also just to kind of have you fill in some blanks in some questions that I would love to ask. So are you ready, sir?
I am absolutely ready. It was a huge, huge amount of work for an enormous team. And we have been really looking forward to the point where people were not just starting the game, but yes, where actually some people had already finished the game, or in the case of very dedicated people had finished the game multiple times.
Yeah, yeah.
So we could actually talk about stuff.
That it is exciting to be able to talk about it. So I reached out to Twitter and asked them, you know, what questions did they have for you? And there were, I don't even know, so many questions about Solus, which we'll get to in a little while. But the first one, I actually got a message from Freddie Prinze Jr. And and I was laughing because he had a question that I think, if you hadn't listened to your first appearance on our show, he wanted to know a little bit about how you became a writer and how you broke in. So I know I've heard the story, and some of our longtime listeners have heard the story, but if you haven't heard the story of how Patrick got started, do you mind telling perhaps an abridged version?
The abridged, the not 45 minutes version.
I loved it.
Well, yeah, I always wanted to be a writer. I just never knew exactly what I wanted to do with it. I've pretty much been writing my whole life. And I was a short story writer. I was a fair to middling dungeon master. I, you know, cranked out a few novels that, you know, never really went anywhere. And BioWare was kind of where things started to click for me, where I really got a feeling for the combination of writing as a creative pursuit and also writing, you know, making it work for me professionally.
Excellent.
And yeah, I mean, and for me, the short version is that that writing really started to work for me when I stopped listening to all the people I was supposed to be trying to impress and really just started writing the kind of stuff that I would want to read. Or as a player, just say like, okay, here's what I would want to play as a player. here's the thing that would interest me. Here's the thing that I think would be fun. I'm not trying to compete with anybody. I'm not trying to impress anybody. Here's the thing that I would want. Because I think you have to write for yourself before you write for anybody else.
That's good advice. Good. Very good advice.
And Mr. Freddy.
Yeah, it was cool for him to reach out. He's been super, super friendly to us, which has been great.
He was such a pleasure to work with.
Absolutely, I bet. So I kind of want to talk about our first playthroughs of the game, just to kind of give the listeners some insight. It's been kind of interesting just hearing of all the different race and class combinations and people's experiences on their first playthroughs of the game, and kind of watching the internet explode over the same topics and things like that. So I'm going to ask Kate first on your first playthrough. What race and class were you, and who did you end up romancing, Kate?
Oh, well, so for my first playthrough, I was a female dwarf rogue, dual wield, and I didn't romance anyone.
Wow.
I tried to romance Blackwall, and then for whatever reason, I stopped getting the prompts, the romance prompts. I fucked up somehow, and so we couldn't close the deal.
But
it ended up being fine because I lost my heart to Scout Harding.
Okay. Got you. So mine, I did a human female warrior. I started off dual wield. No, I started out two-handed sword, and then it went sword and board. And I ended up really absolutely loving sword and board. I thought it was incredibly fun, and it probably is of all. I'm not just saying this because you're on the show, Patrick. Of all the games I played, it's been the most fun with sword and shield. I think I absolutely love the tanking mechanic with guard and all that. I thought it was great.
Really, like, as a writer, this is so far outside my area of expertise, but
yeah.
I felt like, okay, I am usually a pretty terrible tank in games, mm-hmm. and than just being terrible, even when I got to a point of being good at being the tank,
yeah.
I just wasn't interested in being the tank,
mm-hmm.
because it felt like, sit here, let everyone around you do cool stuff,
mm-hmm.
and I love that in our game, with guard generation, and, you know, just combining taunts with abilities that generate guard and abilities that, you know, stun and still do damage and stuff, you can still be a vital part of the team and be more active, I guess. It feels more intelligent to me.
Absolutely. Tons of knockdowns, too. You feel like a badass rather than just a damage sponge, which I really liked. And then I ended up going, for my specialization, I went Templar, which I ended up absolutely falling in love with because it was really, really cool. You know, just the area of effect stun and the combos you can do with that, I ended up just having a blast with it. So, I ended up romancing Sarah, too, and it was just like my first playthrough.
Really?
Yeah, it was super a magical playing experience, not to sound cheesy, but I had this character that I ended up absolutely falling in love with. Alex did her voice, and then the Sarah romance was hilarious, and it just kind of felt like this kind of silly high school romance, you know. It wasn't serious at all, just kind of goofing around, playing pranks, and I really enjoyed that experience. As a player, Patrick, because I know you've played through the game several times, what... perhaps not your first, because I know you played through a number of early builds and stuff, but your first on the gold release, what did you play and what did you end up doing? Just out of curiosity.
Okay, so let's see. My pre-releases... Wow, okay, so we've actually got a nice range. Because I was... Okay, my pre-release, I've done a female double dagger rogue, Romancing Solas, and that was my... See, the question that I like to ask is also, what was your main party? Since some people, they vary their party up.
Yeah.
But... I don't know. I pretty much like to find a party that works with me, and then I'll stick with them for as much of the game as I can.
Okay.
But I had my first playthrough was female double dagger rogue, Romancing Solas, and pretty much characters I wrote in my party because I was trying to make sure nothing broke.
Okay.
And then I had my what I called my Assquisitor playthrough, where I was trying to get as many people hostile as I could.
Awesome.
And she was a female mage. And she was with Bull, Dorian, Sarah. That's my team YOLO, because I think it's hilarious to have them in a group together.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, great.
But then the playthrough I'm in the middle of right now, it's funny because having played through it twice, I haven't actually completed my at home playthrough yet. I've gotten a Skyhold. And I'm also doing it on Nightmare, so it's going fairly slowly for me. And that one, I am a male archer rogue, and I'm romancing Cassandra.
Nice.
Living the dream.
I know. I want to romance Cassandra. Yeah, me too. I got to play as a guy just to do that.
Yeah, he's my Taye Diggs looking elf. He's
nice, very nice.
He's a good looking man.
Awesome. Yeah, it has been really, like I said earlier, really interesting to see the different combinations and stories, that players are kind of generating. You know, each narrative has been different just from watching my Twitter friends kind of explain what they're going through. So it's always cool for me to ask, you know, what was your experience like? Because everyone, honestly, that so far has been different. Although there are a lot of people that have been loving Cullen a lot. I see a lot, a whole lot of Cullen love.
There's a definite presence, yes.
There definitely is, which is great.
Yeah, oh, it's awesome.
So let's talk a little bit. We'll kind of dive into the plot and talk about some plot stuff for a little while. And Kate, obviously, feel free to chime in anytime you want. But one of the first things that I noticed were some of the major differences that popped up even early on in the game. So in the beginning, you kind of get the choice again. Do you want the mages to close the rift or do you want the Templars to close the rift? The first time I went with mages because it seemed like an obvious choice. Because the Templars, especially early on in the game, they're kind of portrayed as like, doesn't one of them like punch a woman in the face? And you're like, how could I ever choose this faction for anything? I mean, it's explained in the, when you choose Templars, it's explained why that happens, because of demon possession. But in the mage playthrough, that's not really explained all that well. So I guess I want to say how incredibly surprised and impressed I was at how different the game becomes based on that decision and how much extra work you guys put into, the plot of the game based on that simple decision. So for our listeners that don't really know what happens, if you choose mages, you essentially get, would you call him a mini boss? What would you
get? Okay. So the big variation is
thank you.
Some areas, depending on, so the easy way to say it is you basically stop, and this is the point where anyone who hasn't played the game and doesn't want to be spoiled should really consider listening to another one of Nerd Appropriate's lovely podcasts. But Corypheus is going after the mages and the Templars. He's playing both sides. Mm-hmm. And whichever side you go to recruit, you get to redeem and save from Corypheus. Mm-hmm. So if you save the mages, then Corypheus gets the Templars, and you get the Red Templar enemy faction as a prominent faction throughout the rest of the game. And if you get the Templars, then Corypheus gets the mages, and you get the Venatori faction as prominent throughout the rest of the game. Now, you will actually see both of them in different areas. Like, if I'm remembering right, in Emprise de Lyon.
Oh, it's so well pronounced.
Oh, thank you, high school French. And 9 years in Canada, I suppose. You will see Red Templars regardless, but there are some areas where it will actually split, and you will see one group that is, you will just see whichever group Corypheus got.
That's amazing. See, I didn't know it was that well pronounced, I suppose. So it was really neat on the second time through, going through, like, oh my gosh, like this whole submission, when I chose the Templars the second time around, I was like, holy cow, like this is a whole new area of the game with, all new dialogue options and essentially a whole new arc. So I was, really, really impressed with that.
And we wanted it to feel it was, so obviously Dave Gator, our lead writer, was the main force behind it. And Sylvia and Mary were the two writers on the individual on the mutually exclusive missions, and then Sylvia also did what we called the nemesis plots, because whoever ended up as your main group had a leader. If it's the Templars, then you ended up facing Samson. If it's the Venatori, you ended up facing Calpurnia. And we wanted them to feel different, and we wanted there to be, an interesting plot arc about finding out this character's weakness, or finding out optionally, if you cared, figuring out what makes them serve Corypheus and how you might turn that against them.
Absolutely. And I remember in the plot involving Calpurnia, I was able to kind of research, why she ended up siding with Corypheus, and through the knowledge that I discovered, I was able to kind of avoid a boss fight with her and kind of send her off to confront Corypheus, which I don't know if I ever really found out what happened to her after that, but...
No, you haven't, because we didn't want to... Well, first off, we didn't want to distract from the main story with that. Mm-hmm. Like, once you sent her off, we kind of wanted that to be resolved.
Yeah, yeah.
But honestly, we really ended up, for lack of a better, we ended up kind of falling in love with Calpurnia. Like,
I liked her a lot too. I loved her background. I thought it was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, but I mean, every part of Calpurnia, you take her voice, her her backstory, and even I love her art. You look at the art and. Even before you get her backstory of this impoverished slave who, through her own intelligence and ability with magic, rose up to the ranks and kind of got handpicked by Corypheus. Even before you realize that, you can look at her and just go, "Wow, okay." Looking at that face, that's someone who, the artist did such an amazing job of showing mm-hmm. someone who was like, "Oh, that's someone obviously someone who had a hard childhood. They probably didn't get a lot of full meals growing up."
Yeah, it's funny you say that because she is not you look at her and she's not like this flawless character. Like, you can definitely see that, she has gone through a lot. And I also love the design on her. When you do encounter her near the end of the game, the design on her costume is amazing. Like her robe that she's wearing, I think is awesome.
Yeah. And she's just clearly, I don't know. She's the villain doing the wrong things for the right reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to know that she didn't get disintegrated or something. I'm like, did I miss like the codex on the floor that says like Calpurnia got turned into dust? I don't know if I didn't find that one, but
it's possible. But
it's possible dust
that we have left the door open so that if she is as popular as we think she is, then there could always be the chance of some kind of some kind of return in something in the future.
That could be super cool. Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about Iron Bull, who you wrote and who I absolutely fell in love with. This is one of the most, I think, unique characters that BioWare has done because he's obviously most of your guys' characters are super conflicted, but he is so lighthearted and just kind of like this very, this jovial, fun-loving, badass character who is... to me, he grew on me more and more and more as I played and I had him in my party, especially when I added my second playthrough. I was like, I'm going to put Bull and Vivian in a party together.
Oh, my God.
And their dialogue is priceless. It's absolutely priceless. And that made me, her dynamic with Bull made me fall in love with Vivian because I didn't really, my first playthrough, I didn't really use her all that much. And I was like, oh, she's just kind of this cold character. But then when I kind of got to know her more. Through her banter with Bull, I was like, okay, I understand her more now, and I think she's great too. So, where did you kind of get the idea for Iron Bull, or where did you kind of refine some aspects of his personality, I guess?
Well, we originally kind of thought of him the all of our characters on the writing front start from a fairly simple premise. And they always get filled in with more detail later. And the premise that we started from was very simple. We've had Sten as a party member, so let's have the anti-Sten.
Mm-hmm.
Let us have someone who, where Sten was stoic, let's have someone who is more emotional. Where Sten is very straightforward about the Kuhn, let's have someone who shows... different pictures of it, a different side of it that makes it a little bit more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of where we started out. And in my very pre-VO, very, very early writing of him, he was sort of a little bit all over the map. And the parts of it that ended up sticking were, I didn't want him to be a brute or a savage, or I didn't want him to be dumb because mm-hmm. honestly, it's just less interesting. When it would be easy to say, haha, because Sten was the smart character. He was intelligent and straightforward. So yeah, he could have had someone who's like, oh, whatever. that didn't feel like it was using it to its to the potential that we had there for it.
Mm-hmm.
And having this guy, having the giant brute with this awesome, fantastic art. who was always a little bit smarter than everyone thought he was. That seemed like an interesting place. That seemed like just room for a character to have more than one dimension. And you brought up Bull and Vivian, and that was kind of one of the funniest things for us, because we looked at it, and that was one of the points where, you know, figuring out that character dynamic was where I realized, okay, you know, this is where he can be a little bit more fully fleshed. This is where he can be a more complex character, because if he's just the Iron Bull, you know, swaggering, not caring about anything, not worried about anything, again, it's less interesting that way. And having him be someone who can be swaggering and not necessarily boastful, but always very confident, and then completely deferring to Vivienne in all respects. you know, that right there, okay, now that's interesting. Now it's like, well, okay, why is he like this sometimes, but like this other times? And it lets players see that there's a deeper character under there, that he's more than just, haha, the tough guy mercenary.
Patrick, if you don't mind me asking, who do you feel like was the most fun to write banter with Iron Bull with? Because I was looking through all of it today, and there are some characters who his relationship is just really fascinating. Like, I didn't expect him and Cassandra to kind of have the rapport that they do.
Yes, well, they're the friendly flirtation of Bull and Cassandra. The always respectful and making sure not to be creepy flirtation with Cassandra. Well, okay, for me, it's probably Bull and Dorian, just because I love their dynamic. And again, I don't know if this is a spoiler.
This whole thing is a spoiler, so spoil all you want, yeah.
But for you guys, if you don't romance either, if you romance neither Bull nor Dorian, and you keep them in the party long enough, they eventually hook up.
What? I didn't know that. I know they flirted. Oh. I didn't know they hook up. That's incredible.
Oh, that makes me so happy.
That's amazing.
That's good.
And again, it's another fun dynamic. And it was great because it's just going around the writer's pit you know, it's about half, okay, what would intellectually make sense? Well, they should have something interesting that grows over time, because Bull is a fighter and Dorian is a mage, and that's going to be a popular, character class combo. So we should make sure that they have something that could stay, you know, interesting over the course of the game. And then really a lot of times in the writer pit, we just kind of, this sounds goofy and silly, but we just start doing the voices at each other.
Oh yeah.
We start doing our own bad imitation of the characters' voices. And, you know, I said something and Dave said something back in Dorian voice, and the room just went, okay, well, now they have to hook up.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is so good. You see, I was not aware of that. That is awesome.
Also worth calling out, I think, is I was one of the things that also really brought the Iron Bull to life was Freddie Prinze Jr. He did such an amazing, like, I was really, really blessed with, all of the characters who I voice act for. Frankly, everyone in the game, I think we had an amazing cast.
You really did, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but Freddie Prinze Jr. was one of the things that I think it would have been really, really easy for me to accidentally make Bull too thuggish, too uneducated, and just blunt. And what Mr. Prinze Jr. brought to the voice was just this level of culture that I think made him more interesting, made him a more fully developed character.
Absolutely.
It's impossible to, you know, that's one of the things that always needs to be reminded. That's, you know, when I'm here answering questions, it makes it sound like I was the person responsible for stuff, and it was an enormous team. You know, John Epler doing all of Bull's scenes, and the character artists who, you know, brought him to life, and Freddie making him awesome.
Yeah, I heard he kind of ad-libbed a bunch of stuff too, and you can kind of, there are some moments you're just like, okay, he's just cracking a joke there that turned out to be perfect and awesome. So
yeah, there are just sometimes where you're like, well, okay, that's better than I wrote the line, so here we go.
That's really funny stuff. Let's talk, I want to ask you about the Chargers, because you as a player are, you know, you're kind of given this incredibly difficult decision. It's like, okay, do I want to have the Kunari on my team, or do I want to keep the Chargers alive? First time I was like, oh, there is no way I'm letting the Chargers die. But the second time I was like, okay, I have to see what ends up happening.
No.
It was horrible. I felt like
you're
such
a monster. How could you?
I felt like such a horrible person. Because in my head, I'm thinking, okay, if I have the Kunari on my team, I'm like, well, maybe Sten will show up and there'll be this like big like Kunari contingent. And I'm like, I'm gonna see what happens. But all that happens is sadness.
It's just a very nice war table ops out of it.
But in reality, like in my heart, I was like, this was a terrible decision from the beginning. You do get some great war table stuff, and you know, you get some new dialogue stuff with some of the characters. But you know, I loved. Did you by chance write the introduction to the Chargers and like create that team?
Oh, the yes. So yeah, I was pretty much there for all of the whole character arc. And yeah, the goal was I had one scene to make you sympathize with the Chargers enough that choice would be difficult in any capacity. That was the one scene I had to go, okay, I gotta make you care about them. And in order to make that choice meaningful, that's why we had Krem, you know, right there from the start. And so I was like, okay, I've got Krem. If I can make you care about one person, I can make you believe that there are a bunch of people behind that you can also care about and feel bad if you send them to die. Mm-hmm. But the one scene where it's like, okay, here's where I also get to show you those people.
I loved that scene. It was one of my favorite scenes just because I instantly, and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass because you're on the show, as someone who plays a lot of these games, I think in one scene you were able to You kind of made me feel like I was looking at a Dungeons & Dragons party. And, like, they had all this, like, fun banter between them. They were teasing each other. They all had their specific role. And I'm just like, okay, like, I get the Chargers now. They're awesome. Like, I want to see them on a solo adventure. Like, I want to see them out in the field. Like, instantly, instantly I was drawn to them. And then the decision comes, like, you know, the next half an hour, like, do they die? I was like, oh, no.
It's like, I can totally see them in a separate gang as like a Hawk and Hawk's band of Merry Misfits.
Right?
Right? And it'd be like sending Hawk to die.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was just, oh my gosh.
Game, so.
And I love Dalish's insistence that her staff is a bow. She's certainly not a mage.
Yeah, because again, you've got like one or two lines to get across the idea of a character. And so you can't go for like, this is a subtle character with a lot of complex nuance. I'm like, nope, mage in denial about being a mage.
I loved it. I loved it.
Here's the old guy. Here's Crazy Knife Lady.
No, I thought it was great.
An explosive dwarf.
Yeah. So, to obviously, Kate, you allowed them to live.
Yeah, in both cases, I let them live. You monster.
Wise decision. I know I am a monster. I regretted it instantly. I was like watching the animation of them exploding, kind of like weeping to myself. So.
Well, there is a worse thing you can do.
Is there really?
Not in that particular choice, but I will say if you ever want a what's the most bad I can feel playthrough.
Yes, please tell us.
This was the Asquisitor. Romance Bull after getting the Chargers killed.
Oh.
Does he just, like, weep in your arms?
No, he did not. Since we're on the spoiler playthrough, if you Romance Bull and you save the Chargers, then he's like, you know, hey, I just want you to know I really care about you. You helped me find a place. This is really great. And if you Romance Bull and you got the Chargers killed and you got the Canary Alliance, he's holding you in his arms going, I hope this made it easier for you.
Oh, sympathy. Oh, it's rough.
And you could just get to the point going, and you could actually ask him, wait, are you saying this was just a job for you? Like, no. So, I feel like a terrible, terrible person.
That's amazing.
After getting the Chargers killed.
So Kate, I know you had some questions about Cole. Let's dig into Cole because he's super fascinating. So,
my precious creepy little baby. I love Cole. He's so wonderful. I was really interested. So I read Asunder, and I loved Cole in Asunder, and I kind of wanted to get your take on what it was like to take another writer's character and move them forward.
Super hard would be the short. Dave Gator did an amazing job of establishing Cole in Asunder, and we went around a lot trying to figure out what direction to take him in, and because I think I said something like this in a blog post at some point, but I couldn't just do Cole as he was in Asunder.
Mm-hmm.
Because doing that, I would have just been, well, first off, anyone who, you know, read the book and then plays the game, they've had that character arc. They know, like, the character arc in Asunder is the boy who doesn't know, you know, what he is and is trying to find out. And at the end of the book, he does find out, oh, I'm a demon. And I can't you know, that's not really, you can't pull that rabbit out of the hat twice.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go somewhere new with it. Somewhere that, you know, felt like a growth of the character and a change of the character. And, you know, that still respected what Dave had done, you know, so that wasn't such a huge departure that you couldn't see how the old Cole could get to the new one.
Yeah. I thought it was a very genuine struggle between, is Cole going to be the person he is or the person he wants to be? And you help him make that choice with the help of the other people who've kind of taken him under his wing and have very divergent opinions on what's best for him.
It's funny for me because I really sort of went back and forth, and I think I kind of put myself back and forth. I will say flat out that Cole, Cole was the most difficult character for me to write, and that's in a game where we debatably had an ancient elven god as someone.
Debatedly, huh? we'll get to that one.
But Cole was the most difficult character for me, just because, first off, just the raw sensitivity, the sheer emotion that he felt. And then, yeah, trying to figure out what he is, what he wants to be, what he ought to be, what I want the player to want him to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go back and forth on it, because there were times when I would feel like, okay, this is a Pinocchio story. This is the story about the spirit that wants to be a person, and, you know, the win condition of playing him is turning him more human. But then, you know, just in the same way, okay, you know, are you, is that forcing him to be something he's not? Is that forcing him to try and fake being a person instead of really being, you know, this strange but also compassionate and amazing spirit that he is. So trying to find the balance and to make both stories equally compelling. And it's funny because I've heard from different groups of people, I've heard people going like, well, I'm always turning Cole into more of a spirit because he's obviously happier that way, and that is the right choice for him. That's what he is. And then there are people saying, well, you know, I'm always going to turn him human. That's what he's trying to be. And, you know, forgetting is not the way to solve anything. And I love that people can honestly feel both ways about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you really pulled that out. I mean, they feel like equally fair choices.
And ideally, neither one of them is the win. I mean, if you, kind of when I wrote him, what we sort of tried to do, Dave guided me on this, for which I'm very grateful, is that neither one feels completely positive or completely negative. If he's more spirit, he's obviously happier and at peace, but he's also not erasing parts of himself, but he's letting parts of himself go. He's definitely drifting back toward pure spirit form, which is definitely kind of more alien for a lot of players, and that's going to feel negative. Whereas if he's more human, it's more relatable, but he's also less happy because he's dealing with, you know, human feelings and stuff. Okay, if I can ask, which way did you push him?
I pushed him human the first time and spirit the second, just because I wanted to see what the differences were, and now I can't really decide which I prefer.
Yeah, I went for I went for human both times myself, just because.
Oh.
I kind of, you know, I read Asunder as well, and I felt his story was so interesting, and I kind of felt like that's what he wanted to be all along. You know, like, why would he ever jump into the body of this this dying mage unless he kind of wanted to, other than help. I mean, I kind of feel like maybe his internal motivation was to one day be a human being himself. But I do like the Pinocchio analogy. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the little humanizing, which is a weird word to use, but the little elements about his character, like, if you do push him to become human, he's like, oh, food is gross. I don't want to eat food. And I'm like, yeah, I'm right there with you, dude. It's weird.
Dang, it was much, we didn't have to do it.
That's great. So let's talk for a little bit about Corypheus, if you will. First of all, I think the music chosen for whenever Corypheus shows up is so incredibly epic that every time he shows up, I'm like, oh, shit, it's on. Because he has his epic, epic music behind him. And, you know, to be honest, I managed to have him show up in the game without it, like, really being spoiled that it was him. He was kind of revealed a little bit in some trailers, but I was kind of, to be honest, avoiding some of the trailers prior to release because I wanted to be surprised when I played. So him showing up actually was, you know, was exciting for me because I remember him obviously as the villain from the Dragon Age 2 DLC. So let's talk a little bit about his motivation though, because you know, even after playing a couple times, I'm sometimes a little dense with like really intricate plots. I'll be the first one to admit that. But what exactly is he in your mind really trying to pull off, if you can reveal it? Because I have ideas, but I don't really perhaps know how to articulate it all that well.
Sure. Well, I think that, okay, there are a million different ways to play our game, all of our games. And in Inquisition, you can look at it as the story about building a powerful organization. You can look at it as a romance and elf fruit gathering simulator. Or you can also look at it as a story about faith. And, you know, a lot of people immediately shy away from that, and they're not comfortable with it. That's not the story for them, and that is absolutely fine. We're never really going to force you to engage with that if you're not comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you look at it as a story about faith, then that's where Corypheus's plot arc and where his character motivations really shine through. And, you know, Dave wrote him, so everything I'm saying is, you know, secondhand trying to interpret what Dave did. But you look at, as the player, we always kind of let you say, yes, I believe this this mark on my hand came from the Maker. I was a blessing from Andraste. I am the Herald of Andraste versus, no, you idiots, I'm Dalish. No, I don't believe in anything. You know, we always kind of give you choices on that. And you can look at what your followers believe in as well. Cassandra, as someone who obviously believes in the Chantry and its ideals and is a reformer. Leliana, as someone who... it's funny, I look at Leliana and Corypheus as two of the closest characters, and it never occurs to most people, but they're both burned believers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're
makes
both
sense.
People who believed really, really deeply and had it turn on them. Leliana was, in Origins, this faithful, optimistic person who believed in the Maker and believed that she was chosen for something and believed that the Maker cared. And when you get to Inquisition, with the death of Justinia, Leliana has suffered such a loss that she has lost her faith, she's questioning that same faith, and she doesn't really know what she cares about anymore. And she's trying to find that back. And Corypheus is kind of like a dark mirror of that. Corypheus, if you go back, if you did some of the research, and if you, it's funny, if you did Here Lies the Abyss, in the Fade, some of the things you can click on, we didn't really make this super obvious, but in a lot of the things you can click on, because the nightmare is the creature born not just of fear, but of the fear that Corypheus caused, there's a lot of stuff in there about the Blight, and there are also a lot of bits in there that are about Corypheus himself, or at least a few in there about Corypheus himself. And if you piece those together, I think you can get a picture of a guy who was a believer. And you look at someone who was a believer in a time where, you know, depending on what version of history you're looking at, either Tevinter's religious power was waning, it was becoming more of a political power than a religious power. And if he was one of the high priests, what was he, high priest of Demont? Yes. Doing a kind of desperate pilgrimage with the other priests of the old gods to reestablish power. And, you know, and it works. And he cracks open the Fade with his buddies and they go in. And, you know, in his words, they got there and the seat of the Maker was empty and black. And there was nothing but ugliness and blight, according to him, at least. So in his version of the story, that's... He comes
kind of
back.
Terrifying.
It is. It's like, yeah, it's what if you went to heaven and found out that it was covered with darkspawn?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you got covered with darkspawn just by going there. What if you got covered by blight? You know, maybe not covered with darkspawn. That would be weird. But and then you come out of, you know, you come out of a centuries-long fugue state. How are you going to deal with that? Like, well, I was the high priest of a god, and then it turned out that there's nothing there. And not only is there nothing, there is sucky, spiky, black, ugly darkness. How are you going to react to that? And I think if you look at him in that context, I think his decision to say, well, nope, the universe has to make sense, so I'm going to be the god that the universe needs.
See that? I'm glad you said it that way, because I was kind of, that's honestly what I was believing that he was doing, but it is very interesting. I mean, the idea of faith is so prevalent in this game, and the idea of, you know, what is real and what is fake. And there's, you know, there's a line somewhere in the game, I can't remember who says it at this point, but it might have been Flemeth, where she says, like, what are gods but very powerful beings, or something. Was that Flemeth? I don't remember who it was, but
sounds like Flemeth.
But you know, that line really stuck with me, because I was like, wow, like, the idea of power and the idea of what a deity is so blurred in Inquisition that you start to question, like, okay, well, this, there are so many deep, deep themes within this game, like, where you have these beings of nearly infinite power, but are those beings just really powerful people, or are they actually, you know, deities? So it is, to me, super fascinating as a player to kind of dig through it and try and figure out, you know, what's what. So I love your explanation, though.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You look at the characters that represent faith or that talk about their faith in anything more than a passing fashion, and we kind of tried to show all sides of it. There is fanatical faith. There is the dark side of faith. That is, we will kill you for the Elder One. And then there is there's Mother Giselle, who, you know, doesn't have any magical powers, doesn't have, you know, martial prowess of any kind, but is just going out into the hinterlands in the middle of a war to help people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is in her own way, is you know, one of the most powerful characters in the game.
Very fascinating stuff. Well, since we know that you have limited time, we have to get to Solas. I'll start off by saying my first playthrough, Solas was my bro. I brought him with me everywhere. And he had all my best mage gear on. And then he left with it all. So, Solas currently on my shit list. Second playthrough, I have shunned him. And he is in his basement looking at the sweet art on the walls and being ignored.
Make sure you strip all his gear before the last fight.
And I will, absolutely. I mean, there's so many questions I want to ask you about this, but, you know, I guess the number one question I have, and obviously, you know, there's so much more to the story that we'll, you know, likely hear about one day, but so Solas is the Dreadwolf. So was Solas at one time, this is my question, I don't know if you can answer it, sure. Was he at one time an elf who was sort of possessed by the, I don't want to say possessed, but does an old god or the Dreadwolf inhabit the body of an elf, or has he always just been, has that been him all along?
Oh, Ash, I wish I...
No, you can. You don't have to answer this, Patrick. You really don't.
I know. It's tough because it's one of those things where I keep going, okay, can I answer that? Because have we said in this part of this? I'm not sure we have. But yeah, there are different interpretations.
Okay, that's a good enough answer. Like I said, I don't want to get you in trouble. Because it was revealed that Mithal was Flemeth, and if you choose to drink from the well, you learn a little bit more about Flemeth's origin, I believe, than if you choose to not drink from the well. So I drank from the well the second time, and I learned that, you know, Mithal inhabited the body of a woman who was kind of crying out in anguish and who was begging for help of the gods, and Mithal came to her and possessed her, and that became... And she became, essentially, Flemeth. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that Flemeth was a person, and that the spirit of Mithal came into her.
Okay, good.
She says that pretty clearly.
Yeah, she says that pretty clearly.
I don't think I'm giving anything away there.
Yeah, and I found, you know, the scene, obviously, between Solas and Flemeth was, to me, very jarring, and as it was for most players, I think you probably saw the eruption on the internet of like, WTF, like, what just happened? There's a whole lot of that, but you know, I don't even really know where to begin with the looking at Solas. First of all, I loved the character of Solas. I thought you did a brilliant job with him. He was very, very interesting and fascinating. I found that you know, his love of the Fade and his, especially his, I'm going to use finger quotes here, his loyalty quest where he was going after the mages for, you know, entrapping demons, I thought was a brilliant twist on, you know, what's right and what's wrong. And it actually had me question, like, well, what is, you know, there are two sides to every story, you know. So where did you kind of come up with some of his themes and ideas? And when was the idea introduced to have him sort of be... you know, I mean, I'll just say it. He's sort of the big bad, right?
He at least has the possibility of having yes. Given that Flemeth explicitly says, why did you let Corypheus get your orb? That implies he had something to do with it.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's no backing out of that one. It's like, I handed you the gun that caused the war. You know, it's like... Yeah.
So actually... There is an amazing level of difficulty and opportunity in writing a character who you know the entire time has a giant side to that character that we're never going to show you until the stinger, until the post-credit scene. Dave and I worked together on him pretty heavily because he's somewhat involved in the critical path of the game, in the main plot. For me, what's the right way to put this? I'm really bad at writing bad guys. I would, like, if you give me, hey, write a villain, I will turn in a serviceable villain, and he will probably say snarky things about you. I was the main writer on Here Lies the Abyss. So if you remember when the demon speaking with Corypheus' voice, the nightmare speaking with Corypheus' voice, mm-hmm. is taunting you and all your followers and Hawk and whichever one of your warden allies is with you,
mm-hmm.
that's me writing a villain.
That was so cruel, Patrick. The things that nightmare said to Hawk.
Yeah, it's true.
Saying mean, hurtful things. That's me writing a villain. That's about the best I got. You know, I'm not bad at it, but you know, that's pretty much what I can give you. But if you tell me write someone who is morally conflicted or someone who is doing something awful for you know what he thinks is a fully moral reason, that's where I can really dig my teeth into it. You know, I kind of feel the same way about Morden from Mass Effect.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of parallels there I hadn't considered.
Yeah. Or
been Morden Solas. It would have been very easy to just write Morden as a mad scientist. Again, in much the same way as it would have been very easy to write, you know, the Iron Bull as a brainless thug. But it would have been less interesting. And I don't feel like I would have been able to talk... to really lay it on the line and try to talk anyone into believing that the Genophage was necessary if I had chosen Warden as mad scientist guy. And in the same way, Solas, you know, as we have shown in game, if you put things together, has done some unfortunate things.
But here's the question I have, and you know, and it's obviously open to player interpretation, but you know, playing through a second time and kind of watching the things that, or listening to the things he says, and watching his interactions with the other characters, he's not this soulless asshole. I didn't mean to do that. He's not. I know, it was so bad. I'm sorry. He truly does have feelings for the other NPCs. I mean, for the other companions. I mean, like, you hear his banter with Cole, you hear his banter with the other characters, you're like, okay, he cares about them. He's not, I mean, he might be, you know, he might be an old god, or he might be, you know, not who he claims to be, but he's sort of experiencing, you know, the world, I think, in a new light, and kind of perhaps learning a little bit about humanity on this new adventure. Sort of like, you know, a teenager growing up and becoming an adult for the first time. It was just a weird, looking at it from through a different lens the second playthrough, I was just noticing how, you know, how he interacted with everyone, and it was really, you know, kind of telling.
Well, yeah, he doesn't kick puppies. He is not the person who is going to, he very rarely, in fact, will even suggest something morally questionable. He might approve of it, but what he really approves of is intelligence and thoughtfulness. Even if that intelligence and thoughtfulness is coupled with something that is ruthless, or something that is, you know, that something that is not what you would think of as the nice guy route. It's just, okay, nope, you've thought this through. The most important thing to do right now is eliminate these bad guys. Okay, good, we're going to eliminate those. But like, that's the kind of thing he will approve of. But yeah, he is always the person who's going to look for more thoughtful solutions. He is always someone who, if you look at his banters, one of the things I've, you know, kind of tossed out to people, since I can't really give any hard answers, is if you want to understand Solas, you know, listen to the things that he brings up on his own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the things he talks about, with the Iron Bowl are very, very interesting. He's extremely resistant to the Kuhn and the ideas in the Kuhn, and I think that told me a lot about his character.
Yeah, he is he is one of the strongest believers in freedom of personal thought. And yeah, the Kuhn is one of the things that I say gets him angriest in the game. If you look at the few places he gets really, really angry in the game, it's when talking to Iron Bull. Oh, especially if you sacrifice the Chargers. If you sacrifice the Chargers, they Solas and Bull have one last banter.
Oh boy!
And Solas just cuts him to the bone. It's watching the idiot mages bind his buddy and turn his buddy into a demon.
I love that scene.
That was great. It really took me aback because he's so stoic for the most part, and then it's an explosion of emotion that really was like hit you with whiplash. You're like, oh my god, Solas.
Yeah, he comes out guns blazing. You're like, oh man, he is actually serious about this.
Well, the quiet guy is losing his temper.
Yeah absolutely.
And he gets mad about the Warden's issue.
And that's the other thing he gets very, very angry about. He does not like what the Wardens are doing. He does not like their plan. And he thinks their plan is bad.
It is a pretty bad plan, let's be honest.
It's a super bad plan.
It's a really bad plan. Wasn't that the Architect's plan, if I remember correctly, or similar to it?
Okay, I thought the Architect... Okay, yes. In many ways, yes. It was kill them before they woke up.
Yeah, yeah. And I was hoping he'd pop up again if you let him live, but maybe in the future we'll see him, because he was really interesting, too. And I really loved the calling book. I thought it was a ton of fun.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is possible we will see him in the future. It's on where the franchise takes us.
Patrick, can I ask you about the Solas romance?
Sure.
That was not originally a planned romance, right? Was that a late addition?
Yeah, that was a later addition.
What made you guys decide to do that?
Well, okay. Let me word it so I feel like the honest answer would just make people grumpy with me, but...
Oh, okay. I'm sorry I asked.
I'm here to talk. No. In a way, it was to make it sadder.
Oh, God.
And, hi, Soulless Mancers. I'm so sorry, guys. But yeah, if you want to see the utter sadness of Solas, it's the playthrough in which you're romancing him, because you get to see that he does care about you. It's obvious, I hope, that his feelings for you are not fake, and he cares about you deeply, and he is one step from telling you the truth about himself. The actor, oh man, whose name I always get backwards and I sound like such a tool every time I do it. Gareth David Lloyd or Gareth Lloyd David?
I don't remember. I'm sorry. Okay.
He did a fantastic... Oh God, his voice is just amazing. And he did a fantastic job on the delivery. And if you go with... If you do his romance, there's one key moment where he says... I've been thinking, and you are, you know, you're a beautiful person and so intelligent and thoughtful, and I've been trying to show how much I care about you, and the way to do that is to show that you deserve the truth. And he just breaks a tiny bit on that line. Because that's...
He did that one last night.
Oh, it's brutal.
Because that's the part where he almost tells you on the truth. And then... And then he twists it into telling you about your Valisling instead.
Mm. Yeah, I was gutted. I was like, oh, he's finally going to tell me the truth. And then he was telling me some bullshit about the Valisling. And I was like, damn it, Solas.
We know the truth now, buddy.
Yeah, he chickens out on it. Because in that moment, that's, you know, what I wrote in the VO comments and what, you know, what came across so fantastically. Is he's about to tell you and then pulls back at the last minute. Tells you about the Valisling instead, and then again goes in on the kiss, is so ready to just lose himself and forget about the past, and then he has to push back. And Jonathan Epp, the cinematic designer, just sold it without a word of dialogue at that part. The part where he steps back and his face changes because he knows he has to break it off right there. Or he's going to have betrayed himself. Mm-hmm. I love that, and it is so sad, and it has broken the hearts of many players, and it broke my heart when I wrote it.
That's awesome. That's a great answer. Well, I know we don't have you for much longer, so that is a great answer. That's great. Let's do a couple quick lightning round questions, then we'll let you go do your thing. How's that sound?
Sure, that sounds lovely.
Awesome. Well, first of all, again, thank you again so much for coming on, and it's always a pleasure to have you. So, first lightning round question is, what do you think the Well of Sorrows tastes like?
Okay. Like a honeysuckle?
Honeysuckle.
Yeah, I would see so like a honey.
So not Mountain Dew.
I said it probably tastes like Surge, if you remember Surge. Because everyone would want that. Everyone would want to drink that.
Yeah.
So honeysuckle's a good answer too. I could see people wanting to partake in a giant well of honeysuckle. So
honeysuckle and cinnamon, because I say whenever anyone asks me what anything tastes like, inappropriately about video game, the answer will always include cinnamon in some capacity.
Amazing.
It's towel sweat, it's Garrus's mandibles, everything tastes like cinnamon.
Oh my god! Wait. Someone has asked you what Garrus's mandibles taste like?
They asked what Garrus's skin tastes like.
His
skin.
No!
Oh, did you ever, yeah. I'm not gonna touch that one. I'm just gonna leave that one behind. We do have a couple quick lightning community questions. The first one I'm gonna ask is from Natalie, who's Bayon Natalie on Twitter, and Bayon Natalie asks, "Did you ever cry when you were writing Solas?"
Yes,
you did.
Damn. No, absolutely.
I would have too.
Especially in the romance scenes.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. The next one is from Gaming Lee, and who's at Gaming Lee on Twitter. And Gaming Lee says, does Solas hate all tea, both green and black? What about herbal tea? Is that is quite different from regular tea.
My chance, that scene with him drinking the tea and being unhappy about it, it was great because that was my chance to justify my own personal dislike of tea. It's great to get a chance. No, that's thing. I hate tea. And I always try it. And everyone's like, this one is like apple and raspberry, and it's kind of an infusion, really. And I'm like, wow, that sounds really good. And I'll drink it. And I'm like, nope, still tastes terrible.
Tastes like dirty water, right? Just dirty water.
Yes. So let's be grumpy about it. Okay, so I would say, in fairness to Solus and reluctantly to tea drinkers, Solus really dislikes anything caffeinated because it makes it harder for him to cross into the Fae when he sleeps.
That's a great answer.
Insight, excellent. This one is from Inquisitor Catherine, who is at CatherineB42 on Twitter, and she asks, do you collaborate with an elven expert when you are writing elven dialogue?
Oh, heavens yes. Dave Gator and Mary Kirby. Mary Kirby is sort of generally in charge of a lot of the languages. She handles Qunari culture, but also Qunari and Elven languages. And then Dave, I think, is probably the final go-to guy for Elven lore. So whenever I write something, I'll kind of run it by them and say, okay, guys, here's kind of what I was going for. What do you think? And they'll go, yeah. Or they will say, you know, no, let's maybe use a different word, or even let's make up a new word because you know nothing that we have is close enough.
I love it. All right, and the final closing question, because we know you gotta get out of here, is, has the player's reaction to your characters been what you expected, or did anything surprise you? And that was from Skybly on Twitter. So, has the fan reaction been?
It's been really amazing, positive. I've been so happy about all of it. It's funny because I wrote, at least in terms of the followers, three very, very different people. My kind of joke at work was that I had body, mind, and spirit.
Yeah, you really did.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And they appeal to very different people. And so it's been really nice to see that, you know, there are people who are coming like, oh man, Bull's romance was awesome. Bull is my favorite bro. That's great. And then there are people who, you know, will say like, oh, Solus broke my heart. Solus is so intelligent, you know, really well written. And then there are people saying, oh my God, Cole feels. And it feels really, really good to, you know, have made different people happy in different ways with all the characters.
That's awesome.
We all kind of feel that way. I mean, you know, just across the writing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for coming back for round three. And, you know, just have to say, as a fan of your writing and a fan of the game, you guys really knocked it out of the park. Having so much fun. It's already sucked away hundreds of hours of my life, and I'm sure I'll be playing again in the near future. So it is awesome, and thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And a reminder to everyone to leave the hinterlands.
Absolutely. That is good advice. And, Patrick, where can people find you on Twitter?
I am at Patrick Weeks on Twitter.
And Kate, what about you? Where can people find you on Twitter?
I am at Kate D on Twitter. That's K-E-I-G. Oh, I forgot how to spell it. K-E-I-G-H-T-D-E-E.
Excellent. Awesome, guys. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you later.
Hey everyone, this is Veronica Belmont, and you're listening to the Rated NA podcast at nerdappropriate.com. Nerds.
Thank you guys so much for tuning in to episode 184 of the Rated NA podcast. Big thanks again to Mr. Patrick Weeks for coming on the show for the third time. Thanks to Kate Dollarhide for hanging out on the episode, and thanks to Matt and Scott for an awesome year at Rated NA. We'll be back in 2015 with all new episodes, all new guests, all new fun stuff. If you want to follow us on Twitter, that's at NerdAppropriate on Twitter. You can email us directly, and that is Matt, Scott, and Ash at NerdAppropriate.com. And we have a Facebook page, and that is /NerdAppropriate on Facebook. We will see you guys soon. And again, thank you guys for an amazing year.